Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Welcome. I'd like to have you with us this morning. It's Tuesday, November 14th, which means it's about 10 days away from Thanksgiving. I was surprised to see that it's going to be on a Thursday again this year. Funny how that works out. Here's a verse from 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. It says, "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit." Encouraging words this morning. Thank you for what you did on the cross. Thank you. You made me, the unrighteous, righteous. Brought me to God. Thank you. Very grateful this morning. Here's a story that made me laugh out loud, and I can't help but to share. A streaker who invaded the field during the Buffalo-New Orleans games ran for more yards than the entire Bills team. Five Bills players carried the ball 15 times for 69 yards. That's the offensive team for the Buffalo Bills. The Buffalo News reports one naked guy sprinted from end zone for 100 yards. Security finally tackled him as he was trying to make a move to cut across the field. He was escorted off the field with a yellow security jacket covering what needed covering in 41-degree temperatures. And if I were the owner of that team, I would offer this guy some kind of deal because he actually got more yards than his entire team in the game that day. There you go. All right. We got Rob Bluey on our line. We're looking forward to speaking to him. We'll get him on in just a minute. And then we've got John Bloom from Desiring God. What an interesting man he is. And then Dr. David Stevens is going to be with us. And then, time permitting, Brad Sickler from right here at the University of Northwestern teaches philosophy. We're going to grill him. Oh, boy, is he in trouble. Wait till he gets in studio. You're going to want to get your hand on the phone because you'll probably have a question for him. But we're going to have a great, great show. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back with Rob Bluey. Good morning, it's 8 minutes after the hour, and that is Rob Bluey's theme song. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, I love it. Great way to start the day.
Makes you happy, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Say, Rob, so the press is getting a sneak peek at the Museum of the Bible, I think today.
That is correct, and the Daily Signal will be there, I believe, tomorrow is
okay.
When we're scheduled to make a stop over there. We're excited. You know, this is one of those things. It's uniquely a Washington type of tradition where we have so many museums in Washington. Of course, the Smithsonian's, which are all free for all Americans to enjoy. But we're really spoiled in Washington to have them right in our backyard and be able to take the kids and others to see. And with the opening, soon opening of the Museum of the Bible, I think it's another great addition to the Washington scene.
I have a feeling that is going to get a lot of attention. There's going to be a lot of visitors pouring in there.
Oh, absolutely. And the previews that I've read about it are just incredible. The length that they've gone to make it interactive and really something that you can enjoy and the kids can enjoy in 2017. So, yes, it's going to be a popular destination, no doubt.
Yeah, Rob, what is the price tag to open a museum in your neighborhood? What does that cost, roughly?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you put me on the spot. I mean, definitely probably hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay.
I don't have a precise price tag on you. So the Smithsonian's opened the Museum of African American History last year.
Okay.
And you actually need tickets to get in because it's so popular. And I have not been. Now, my 8-year-old son has gone on a school trip, but I have not yet been. My brother-in-law has been, and a lot of other people that I know have been. But yeah, it's not like the American History Museum or the Natural History Museum where you can just walk up. You know, and even it was over at the Natural History Museum back in September with my parents, and these are still very popular destinations. We had to wait in line to get into the museum, so definitely a great experience for families, and one of the more definitely one of the more pro family things that you can do in Washington.
That's awesome. So I was hearing about President Trump's Asia tour from him, and he was he's always so positive. I always appreciate everything is spectacular in his world. It's actually kind of encouraging. What did you think about his trip to Asia?
That's right. So he's wrapping up the trip. He has one more meeting that he's doing, and he has been very positive about it. And to be honest with you, Bill, the press coverage has, I thought, been positive as well. They're you know, they found their little ways to needle him. He didn't shake hands correctly, this or that. But for the most part, it seems that he's been able to push forward with his agenda, which is for better trade deals. I think that was one of the main takeaways from this trip, where he wanted to make clear to China and some of the other countries that he visited that the United States is approaching trade deals differently under his administration. And then also really focus on the threat of North Korea. North mm-hmm. Korea continues to be a big focus of his, and obviously that's the region that's you know, most impacted by North Korea in terms of where its missiles can reach. Although, you know, as we've been hearing, you know, increasingly it seems that the United States is a threat from these missile attacks. So both an economic agenda and a security agenda were big on President Trump's plate.
Apparently, he's over the 12 days he was there, he said that there were more than a dozen deals made with Chinese companies worth $9 billion. So he was trying to do some deals while he was there. It seems that he's backed off from calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man. I didn't hear Rocket Man mentioned once. Did you?
No, he didn't, although he did refer to him as short and fat. I don't know what's a bigger insult. You know, he says he was responding to an insult that Kim Jong-un made against him.
Uh-huh.
There clearly continues to be, you know, tension there between the two countries. And as we've talked about, Bill, on the show, Kim Jong-un, I think your listeners have to remember, really does not have a whole lot going in his favor. So the one thing he can do is make these threats, and that's what generates the media attention and the coverage, and that's what puts North Korea back in the headlines. It's not like North Korea has a dynamic economy and you know, great products. You know, the trade is minimal, and the people are really suffering there. So this is his way of saber-rattling and getting attention.
Yeah. Rob, where are we with the budget talks?
Well, you know, this is coming up pretty quickly after Thanksgiving. December 8th is when the government funding runs out. So mm-hmm. Democrats are already saying that they are willing to shut down the federal government if it comes to it. They want to make sure they get into legislation some sort of a deal on DACA, which are the dreamers, the children of illegal immigrants who were brought to this country, you know, some at a young age, some as teenagers. And President Trump made a decision to basically defer you know, any sort of action on this at his from his vantage point until March. But the Democrats are saying they want to use the budget talks that are coming up on December 8th to force his hand. And so a lot of us in Washington are wondering if we'll have a pre-Christmas government shutdown, which doesn't seem to work in anybody's favor. So we're going to be watching that one closely. And, of course, happening at the same time that all of that discussion is happening is tax reform, which, mm-hmm. you know, it seems that Republicans are eager to get that done because they don't want it to interfere at all with the threat of a government shutdown.
They kind of need something in the win column pretty soon, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely do. You know, coming on the heels of last week's significant losses in Virginia. I think not a whole lot of people were surprised that the governor of New Jersey, the governor of Virginia, were Democrats who were elected last week. But it was at the lower level, the fact that the Democrats erased a pretty substantial margin among Republicans in the House of Delegates in Virginia that has a lot of Republicans in Congress worried that that same type of a wave could sweep across the country next year during the midterm elections if they don't get something done, and they failed to get Obamacare repeal done. And so now tax reform is so close, really. It's going to pass the House this week. It's probably going to move out of the Senate committee this week. But getting it across the finish line is always the toughest thing, as we saw with Obamacare.
Rob, did you get the idea that Hillary Clinton was trying to take a little bit of responsibility for the victories last week?
No doubt about it. I mean, I think that Hillary Clinton just won't go away as much as anybody might want her to. And in some cases, Republicans don't want her to, and we could talk about that in a second. But with regard to Virginia, you have to remember that Terry McAuliffe, who's the current governor, is a longtime Clinton associate, somebody who made his rise in politics largely because of the Clintons. So not only is he, you know, championing it, but I mean, I think they're pointing back to Hillary Clinton and some of the resistance that has fueled such activism among Democrats and liberals as one of the reasons as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we should note, and you're talking to me when I'm in Virginia right now, so I mean I pay close attention to this because I am a resident of the Commonwealth myself. Ralph Northam, who's the governor-elect, immediately after his election, despite all of the progressive talk about how, you know, resistance, basically came out and said he's willing to work with President Trump, particularly on military. Certainly doesn't seem like a big issue of the progressives. And he had very, you know, moderate things to say on some of the other issues. So he ran as a moderate. He was not endorsed by the progressives. In fact, they ran a progressive candidate against him, who he beat. So we'll see how he actually governs. I think that there might be some liberals who are disappointed, though.
Mm-hmm. Rob, let me go to break. When I come back, I want to ask you about President Trump has about 175 pending nominees awaiting action from Senate committees and what your take is on that. It's 16 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Rob Bluey. Be back in a minute. Nineteen minutes after the hour, speaking to Rob Bluey, who's editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. And Rob, it looks like there's about 175 pending nominees awaiting action from the Senate committee for confirmation. And it looks like the Democrats might be using some delay tactics. What's with that?
That's right. Well, one of the big impediments to President Trump's implementing an agenda is the fact that he doesn't have the people who are actually in place to do it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are in acting positions or serving kind of in a temporary capacity because they haven't been confirmed by the Senate. And this is unprecedented delays and obstruction on the part of Democrats. They've never really done it to this level. And what they do is because in the Senate, as we've all heard about, there's something known as the filibuster. Well, even though the Democrats can't actually filibuster any of these nominees, in part because they changed the rules back in 2013 to ease the passage of nominees for President Trump, what they are able to do is require 30 hours of debate for every single nominee. And so, and this is, you know, the Senate can basically only get, at most, we've seen five nominees done in a week, and that's even when the Democrats give back some time because they want to get out of town earlier. So what you have a situation where basically the only work that the Senate is doing now is to confirm nominees. They're not considering legislation because any time that they spend considering legislation, they're not confirming nominees. And there's this long list of executive branch and judicial nominees that has piled up over 100, and it's concerning because Mitch McConnell himself said it would take 11 years at the current pace to confirm these nominees. Well, as we know, President Trump might only have about, you know, three more years, unless he's reelected, in which in case, you know, he'd probably have even more vacancies to fill because people mm-hmm. would be leaving jobs at that point.
Mm-hmm. I'm just impressed how smoothly the word judicial rolls off your tongue at this time of the morning.
Well, and that is, you know, speaking of judicial, that's one of the
not an easy word to say.
That's one of the areas that there has been a point of success. So the White House put out some of the points of success last week on the 1-year anniversary, and he has moved quickly to put judges on the bench for lifetime appointments. So long after President Trump leaves the White House, a lot of these judges will still be in place at the district and appellate court level. And, of course, there's Neil Gorsuch at the Supreme Court who's already made his mark.
Mm-hmm. Rob, just how dirty is politics? Is it the dirtiest of all dirties?
Pretty dirty, and you're going to see a little bit of that on Capitol Hill today. I hope your listeners pay attention to Jeff Sessions' testimony, because he is going to get hit from both sides. Let me tell you, this might come as a surprise to some people who are fans of Jeff Sessions, but you have obviously the Democrats who are upset because they see dirty politics when it comes to Russia and interference and the Mueller investigation, but Republicans are equally upset with Jeff Sessions on Capitol Hill because he has not appointed a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton, Uranium One, and some of the other scandals that have been circulating in the Democrat side. So lots of politics on Capitol Hill today.
Yeah, so Loretta Lynch is going to allow a Russian agent to enter the U.S. so they could meet with Donald Trump Jr. So she would then have permission to spy on them. So
it's,
come on, this is dirty, right?
It's so crazy what's going on, and at times you're just left scratching your head and wondering who you can believe, who you can trust, and I think that's one of the things that's going to be difficult for somebody like Jeff Sessions, who's the nation's top law enforcement officer, somebody who really was instrumental in helping President Trump, the first senator to endorse him. He has this you know, very important job in the administration, and yet it seems that the president himself has lost confidence in him. He keeps tweeting about the Justice Department not doing enough. So, you know, in a way, you want the attorney general to be independent of politics, but certainly Jeff Sessions has been dragged in the middle of a lot of it, in part because of what's happened with Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch before him, his predecessors, mm-hmm. but also because of what's playing out today.
And I believe, Rob, and correct me if I'm wrong, the overarching premise on all of this is none of this matters when Hillary gets elected president, because it all goes away.
That's right. Well, had Hillary been elected president, you better believe there would be a lot of this would have been brushed under the rug and never heard from again. But yeah, look, there are some you know, crazy conspiracy theories out there, and the latest one I heard is there's a real big push among Democrats in the House, if they do retake control of the House next year, to immediately mount an impeachment campaign against President Trump. Now, he probably wouldn't be convicted in the Senate, but they might make an effort, and Cass Sunstein and other legal professors are already writing books and working with Democrats to try to, you know, foment some of this resistance against the president. So, oh boy, Bill, it's a dirty place, that's for
sure.
Yeah.
Rob, what's the word on the street in Washington about James Comey?
Well, James Comey, you know, has, I think, just about upset and alienated both sides,
okay.
Everybody on both sides.
That'd
of the
be my guess.
Because you know, at times, you know, obviously the Clinton people were upset with him that he came out and made a statement weeks before the election that, you know, he was investigating. And you know, now the Trump people are upset with him, and Trump ended up firing him. So James Comey finds himself in a position where few are rallying to his defense. And, in fact, I think you're going to hear some questions today at the Jeff Sessions hearing in the House about James Comey and maybe some of the roles that he did play.
Mm-hmm. J.J. Watt goes on the campaign to try to raise $200,000 for the people in Houston from Hurricane Harvey, and he now has raised $37 million. And somehow Colin Kaepernick is Citizen of the Year with GQ.
Yeah, I saw that. That's baffling. I mean, here you have a situation where, you know, he has really done something that's been very divisive for our country, and also I think has probably harmed the NFL in ways that I'm not sure it'll ever be able to completely recover with its ratings being down and some fans saying that they've just given up entirely. So I understand perhaps a little bit of the liberal love of Colin Kaepernick and you know, being defiant and standing up for things that he believes in. But at the same time, it seems that there are so many other great Americans who you could honor, the GQ could honor, other than him.
Yeah, speaking of GQ, and not to embarrass you, with your chiseled good looks, have they ever contacted you?
No, I'm afraid not, but I doubt that very many conservatives have the opportunity to do anything positive with GQ.
Rob, thanks so much for being on the show. Always look forward to chatting with you. Have a great week.
Thanks, Bill. You too.
You bet. It's 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and then lighten up with Ken Davis.
This is your daily dose of devotion. We buy in bulk and pass the savings on to you. It's the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
It is 30 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us this morning. We're going to take a little break for news, and then we're going to talk to John Bloom from DesiringGod.org. Be back in a minute.
You got it. Put on a happy face.
Finding encouragement together.
I have actually grown up listening to this with my parents driving in the car. Well, I could definitely tell you there have been days where I felt like the programming that I was listening to was absolutely geared for what I was going through that day. There were many times where I was just absolutely defeated from situations during the day, and listening to the programming, I would feel completely rejuvenated, refreshed, like God had that word planned specifically for me.
Thanks for making us your radio home. Faith Radio.
Good morning, 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Being rooted in Christ, that's what Bannon Leapshire, who's a pastor and an author, says. What does it mean to be rooted in Christ? He says that he shares his thoughts why people are confused about this. Let's hear.
When a seed is planted, the next step is not fruit. The next step is roots. And we somehow have forgotten that a little bit. We're so excited about the vision. We're so excited about the passion of the word God's given us. We don't realize that when he plants a seed, he then starts a process. And that process is to grow your internal world, your root system, because your internal world has to be strong and healthy. And so he goes about to do that. And we get frustrated because it's below the surface. You can't see it. It's in hiding. It's messy. But I would say the most important part of growth in your life, the most important part of growth in a plant is below the surface, is the root system. And I think that those that really embrace the process that God has them in to allow him to develop a root system are the ones that bear fruit that remains. And we've lost a little bit of this because we don't live in an agricultural age. So honestly, for some people, it's confusing. It's odd for them, because it's not happening right now. So we literally, I have an iPhone. I am frustrated if it takes 3 seconds to load. So I will go spend $900 to get a new iPhone. And when somebody asks me, what does it do different? It loads 1 second faster. And so we're just in a society that, like when Jesus taught and when the Bible was written, it was agricultural. So when he said, listen, a seed goes in the ground, they understood this process. Now there's a process that's about to happen in that seed. We've lost that a little bit because of our technological kind of age. So I think the rooted last because they are the ones that have allowed God to develop their internal world so that what's inside of them is bigger than what's outside of them. And they're the ones that really make a lasting impact.
That was Mr. Leapshire. What a great name. Bannon Leapshire. I wonder if that's his name he was born with, because, you know, I was thinking I need a flash. I decided when I was younger I needed a flashier name for show business, so I changed my name to Bill Arnold. So I just thought that was flashier, because when I was born, my name was Sterling Maximus. But I felt like I needed a flashier name. Bannon Leapshire, what a great name. We'll take a little break, and then John Bloom's with us from DesiringGod.org.
Do you know that marriage between a man and a woman committed to one another is the best environment for sustaining human life? This is Jim Garlow. Wayne Grudem, in an exhaustive work titled Politics According to the Bible, cited research conducted by the Heritage Foundation. It shows that children with their own two married parents are less likely to end up in poverty, commit crimes, and to engage in alcohol and substance abuse. And they're more likely to have physical health and emotional health, higher standards of integrity, and higher moral principles. In fact, the greatest predictor of poverty and a child being at risk is for a child to not have a married daddy and mommy. At the core of the issue is the fact that children need and deserve a mother and a father. Be well-versed. There's more to share with you at jimgarlow.com. Be prepared to live out your faith.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show. Every day is my lucky day here at Faith Radio, and today is no exception. I have in studio John Bloom. He serves as author, board chair, and co-founder of Desiring God. How cool is that? He's the author of three books, Not by Sight, Things Not Seen, and Don't Follow Your Heart. He and his wife live in the Twin Cities with their five kids. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about your books, and then we'll move on. I've got a bunch of questions to ask. Don't Follow Your Heart, is that the most recent book you wrote?
Yes.
And then what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean a lot of things. So the book is a collection of short meditations, really.
Okay.
On various heart problems that we have.
Awesome.
The biggest problems that we have in our life are heart problems, and so our heart tends to lie to us frequently, and so we always must be on guard, in various ways to protect ourselves from our own hearts.
Yeah,
longings, and so it's playing off the real popular phrase "follow your heart,"
right?
That our culture likes to promote, but I have found in my own experience that is frequently very bad advice.
But we're kind of obsessed with our feelings, and we oftentimes want feelings to be the most important thing. And I always think that our thinking should be more important than our feelings. I mean, when Jesus was in the wilderness after 30 days of no food. And Satan tempted him, he responded with his thinking. It is written. He didn't respond with his feelings. Like, you're right, I really am hungry. I could really use some bread.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, we are very complex creatures. And so you can probably think of times when your feelings are affecting your thinking. And so something is going on inside and it's producing a mood. You're barely aware that it's there, but all of a sudden you find yourself cranky or irritable or sad or depressed or discouraged or whatever, and you're not even sure why. And so there's that, but of course our thinking is meant to lead our feelings. And so that's the point, is that we must always trust God's promises over our perceptions. And that's really that theme flows through all three of my books.
Awesome. Now let's get to something a little bit more recent. You recently wrote an article for Desiring God entitled If Only, and I think that's another interesting topic for all of us, because we all have if only I hadn't, and then filled in the blank. If only this would happen, my life would be happier.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that, some of the regrets, and obviously some are unavoidable because we're sinners. So.
Yeah, well, I titled this article If Only, because if only is just a way of articulating a regret. When we're saying, oh, if only this could have happened, or if only I did this, or if only I didn't do this, or if only so-and-so hadn't done that, or if only so-and-so had done that, or if they had said this or hadn't said that, whatever it is that we feel, if only, it's some form of regret. And those, we live with regrets. They're just a very real part of our life. We all feel if onlys regularly, right? I mean, so we have it because we are sinners. And we also have it because we live with sinners. So our lives are intermingled, and we interact with other people. And so their sin affects us, our sin affects them. And we live in a world that's riddled with futility, according to Romans 8:20. And so everything is always breaking down, and so there's all sorts of regrets that can happen because of that. And then we live in a world, as the Apostle John says in 1 John 5:19, we live in a world under the power of the evil one. So that means we are also affected by spiritual forces of wickedness that oppress and afflict, and they can cause their own forms of regrets in our life.
John, what part does expectations have in the if only discussion. I mean, and I sometimes think of a great line C.S. Lewis has about if before you enter a room, you're told it's a honeymoon suite, and you open the door and you go, oh, this isn't that great. But before entering the same room, you're told it's a prison cell. You open the door and go, oh, this isn't bad.
Yeah.
You know, so how do expectations, where do they come from? How much should we focus on them? And then how much does that create the if only had I not? I mean, where did you get that in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question, because in the article that I wrote, I drew – there's two different kinds of if onlys. There are if onlys that are attached to real things that have happened in our past.
Okay.
They're almost always things that have happened in our past that we feel regret over.
Sure. Or ways in which we were harmed.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's things that we have done or things that have been done to us, or things that we haven't done.
Yeah.
Or things that haven't been done to us.
Factoids.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are real regrets. But we also have what I call fantasy if onlys or fantasy regrets. And what you're talking about, those expectations,
mm-hmm.
they're often in that realm. So there are things that we imagine, the things that we desire,
mm-hmm.
and they, of course, play significantly into like what we're anticipating and whether or not we're disappointed, and we mm-hmm. frequently are. Those kinds of regrets are frequently just as powerful as real regrets.
Interesting.
And they're more insidious because they're harder to identify. Because you can live with almost a chronic sense of disappointment because you have embraced messages that you had in your family, you gained from your friendship circles, you got from your wider culture, and just your own desires, some of them legitimate and some of them sinful. But we build these things, and they're often – here's what happens – they produce mirages. So our expectations can produce mirages. They're not real. They're not made out of things that are real, but we have this vague sense that this is the way things ought to be.
Yeah. Oh, I bet everybody feels that way.
Everybody does. Everybody deals with this, and it affects life significantly.
Oh, yeah.
It affects relationships, marriages, all sorts of family issues can be affected by our fantasy if onlys.
Right. Yeah, so we have to be awfully careful. You know, when I think of our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God, and then we're encountering a incredibly holy and perfect God, that we would have this idea that we can have these fantasies about how we expect our life to go
right.
is a little nutty to me at times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's part of the curse. We create in our own minds virtual realities, and we think that's the way things should be, and we think God ought to conform to that. And those are insidious. They're not easy to spot, and they are very common. And so what we need to be doing is rooting our hope in specific promises that God makes. What does God say reality ought to be?
Thank you.
What does God say marriage ought to be? What does God say parenting ought to be like?
Yes.
What does God say that life ought to be like in general, the course of your life?
Mm-hmm.
Because the more you align yourself with what God describes, how God describes reality in scriptures, really the more happy you can become, because the expectations that he places before us are much greater than our own.
Mm-hmm.
Even if in short term, we experience more suffering than we would want to experience. Our future is much brighter than any future that we could create on our own. So his reality is much better than our virtual realities, but we often switch those in our minds, and they can create just chronic disillusionment.
Wow, that is some wisdom. I'm talking to John Bloom. He's author and board chair and co-founder of Desiring God. He's in our studio. We'll take a short break and continue our interesting conversation with him in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm so glad you're listening, and I hope you have heard the first part of my conversation with John Bloom. And if you have not, go to the podcast at myfaithradio.com. Make sure you get it all in. He is an author, a board chair, and co-founder of Desiring God. He's the author of three books, Not by Sight, Things Not Seen, and Don't Follow Your Heart. And we're talking about if onlys a little bit, the if part. If that would have happened, my life would have been happy. Or if that I didn't have had that happen to me, things would be different. And we can be awfully stuck in a place of dysfunction and self-pity and self-loathing when, in fact, what you just said before break was God's got this incredible plan and vision for your future.
Yes.
And we self-sabotage by sitting around feeling sorry for ourselves.
Yes. Yes. I mean, self-pity is a huge issue in anybody's life. It's a manifestation of pride because it's rooted in our wanting to define ourselves the way reality ought to be. That doesn't mean that regrets are illegitimate. There are lots of legitimate things that we ought to feel regret over, things that we have done or that have happened to us that should not have been done. And there are, I mean, we are meant to lament in a broken world that's riddled with futility and riddled with evil. And so we can live with regrets. There are lots of regrets expressed in the Bible. You can have a very robust view of God's sovereignty over everything and still have regrets. And one of the most interesting examples to me is you got Romans 9. You know, Paul in Romans 9 just expresses God's sovereignty over evil and election, all those kinds of things in the most clear place in the Bible, in that chapter. But he begins the chapter with this expression where he says, I am telling the truth in Christ. I'm not lying. Mm-hmm. I have unceasing anguish and sorrow over my kinsmen, his Jewish kinsmen, who are rejecting the Messiah. Regret. He says, I would that I could be accursed on their behalf so that they would believe. That's a statement of if only they would believe. Mm. That's a legitimate regret. And yet, he goes on then to express his deep confidence in God, which is where we need to end up if we're going to escape self-pity. Anxiety is a daily temptation for most of us. In our own unique ways, in our own unique circumstances, we're always dealing with anxieties. We're always dealing with trouble. Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble, tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
But take heart, I have overcome the world. That is the paradigm. That is the way that the Christian is meant to live. We need to, on one hand, expect trouble. Things are going to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is overcoming it all.
How do you interpret the take heart? I've also heard the expression, be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And I always love that because I wonder how often are Christians characterized as people of good cheer?
Yeah.
We're kind of the solemn, you know, angry type or come across as the unloving folk. I mean, we should just be full of joy.
Well, we should. We should be full of joy. And that really gets to the root issue of anxiety. So when you said that's John 16:33.
Yes.
In this world you will have tribulation, but take heart. That phrase you could say take heart.
Uh-huh.
You could say be hopeful.
Okay.
You could say, take courage.
Yes. Be bold.
Be bold. Yeah. Yes. Like don't faint. Don't fall. Don't cave in. Don't be full of self-pity.
Yeah.
Take heart. I've overcome the world. You have every reason to be hopeful. Now, I can hear people as they're hearing you and I talk going, yeah, but you don't understand my situation. You
right.
do not understand the issues that are causing me anxiety. And the truth is, even though you and I don't know that, God does know that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a high priest who's able to sympathize with us in our weaknesses because he's been tempted in every way just as we are. That's from Hebrews 4. And he knows. He's the one who said that. He has been through the most anxiety-riddled moments that a human being could possibly experience. And he then gives us every possible reason to hope. I point to Psalm 27 because Psalm 27 is this beautiful articulation of what real life actually feels like. So David begins with saying, you know, the Lord is my light and my salvation. whom shall I fear? And that means he's got fearful things going on. So he's telling to his soul, hey, I don't have any reason to fear. And then in verse 4, he says, one thing I ask of the Lord, and that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. And so he brings himself to, what is the thing that I want the most? What is the very source of my hope? Out of what will spring all the other hopes that will address all the anxieties and fears that I have? God, above everything else, God, I want you. You are the one thing I want more than anything else.
Beautiful. It's just a moment of refreshment just to be hearing you speak, John, because it's, I know every listener right now on their busy way to work or a day filled with activity, they've got a sense of anxiety. It's just present. Or like you say, it's a temptation that we say, yeah, I'll take some of that today because it'll maybe keep my fire going. And it's counterproductive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. You just think, I mean, if you're anxious, you spend all sorts of just energy and emotional resources trying to cope. But when you are operating in a place of hope, you have much greater capacities for energy and tolerance. When your heart is hopeful, is anxious, it narrows everything down. It constricts everything.
Yeah. Brilliant way to close out our interview with John Bloom. He's the author, board chair, and co-founder of Desiring God. Just a delight having him here today. John, thanks again.
That's great to be here.
Yep. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Thank you to John Bloom. A listener named Lynn already let me know that was a good message and a good way of viewing our expectations versus reality. We have a great second hour coming up. Dr. David Stevens is going to be with us, and boy, do I have a bunch of questions for him. He is going to get peppered today by me. And then Brad Sickler is going to come by, we hope. We hope. Are you up, Brad? Let us know. We're going to talk to Brad. And that's going to be our second hour. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.